wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, part two of Bill Resnick's conversation with John Bellamy Foster about civilization and its future. Fran Michel discusses the books Health Communism and Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Patricia Kohlberg reads from an open letter to U.S. educational authorities in honor of tomorrow's National Teachers' Day. And from the archive, Fran Michel and Hyung Nam discussed the origins of May Day. First up, Bill Resnick talks to John Bellamy Foster, editor of the Monthly Review and author of books such as The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet, about the future of this planet and civilization itself. Part 1 aired last month on April 10. Search for that at kboo.fm. This is the conclusion of that interview. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with John Bellamy Foster for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick talking to John Bellamy Foster, part two of my interview with John, who teaches sociology at the University of Oregon, also lead editor of the Monthly Journal, Monthly Review. He's written 10 books and edited 10 others. They include The Ecological Rift, Capitalism's War on the Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. We discuss the future of the world as it continuously warms, wreaking havoc, vast destructive storms, spiraling food prices, whole populations desperately fleeing, ocean level rise, flooding most of the big cities of the world on the coasts, and more. At some point in this ruinous trajectory, people around the world will awake and demand the total mobilization of all Earth's resources to stop the current death march. We conclude today discussing what must be done, and that we have all the necessary resources and technologies to succeed. Another better sustainable and democratic world is necessary, and it's possible. So, John, first the future. First the time we have left to meet the climate threat. Not much time, I'm afraid. And then how and for what the left can organize.
Yeah, I agree with the things that you say. In terms of the 2030 and 2050 marker, 2030 is really about getting carbon emissions down by at least 30% and from where we are now. And that doesn't mean that we're talking about waiting till 2030. We can't. This is 2023, and there are 7 years in which the world has to somehow reduce carbon emissions by about 30%, and then 20 years after that, carbon emissions have to go down to, well, by 2030, it's really by 40%. And by 2050, we have to hit net zero carbon emissions is the way they refer to it. But we basically have to eliminate carbon emissions by 2050. So you got 7 years to get the emissions down by 40%. And 20 years after that, we have to get down to zero. And so this is, you know, to even talk about that is not talking about waiting. It's talking about we need to reducing our carbon emissions on a daily basis. We need a transformation of the entire production system of the world and on a revolutionary scale. And this is what the science is now saying. The mitigation report of the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their AR6 report, and the mitigation part of that, the part three that came out last year, said that we had to pursue low energy solutions. It's understood in the science now that we don't have any technological solutions. Certainly we can promote solar and wind, but we don't have any technological solutions like carbon capture and sequestration. They don't even exist on scale or nuclear or anything else that can solve this problem. And you know, what we need is to actually reduce energy usage by changing the way in which the economy operates. So we need low energy strategies now. And we can do things that reduce energy usage, but we have to have a different kind of production system and a different set of priorities. And that's what the IPCC report was saying. Only that's what the scientists wrote, but the governments have the right to censor the summary of policymakers written by the scientists. So the governments came in and they rewrote the whole statement of the scientists before it was published. We know this because it was leaked. The original report was leaked, and we put it up on the monthly review site. So we know what the science said as opposed to what the government said. And the governments came in and removed what the scientists said about the need for low energy solutions. They removed what the scientists said about eliminating coal-fired plants and so on right down the line. So we're being lied to in terms of what the governments are telling us, even through the IPCC, and keeping us from hearing what the science demands. The great UK medical journal, The Lancet, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, just came out last week with a big report saying that the only solution was low energy solutions, and this would require a restructuring, transformation of our entire production system to create a society also that was more equal, because we can't reduce the energy usage to the extent that is needed without also creating a more egalitarian system. They require each other. So we know these things at this point. What you said about there probably being extreme weather events that coalesce in the next decade that will create enormous emergencies all over the world, we're already seeing that. And the part two of the latest IPCC climate report basically deals with the damages. It spelled that out. Well, parts one and two spelled that out, that we're facing these extreme coalescing weather events, things like the wildfires in Oregon, you know, combined with drought and whole regions moving from drought to floods. Look at Pakistan. They had the more that you have global warming, the more you have water remains in the air, and the monsoon was increased as a result of their heat waves and their drought. The monsoon was increased, and then they had floods that flooded 30% of the country. And these things are going to be more common all around the world. And it's not just a question of what we do or experience here in the United States. It's all over the planet. And this is a situation where in the last summer's issue of Monthly Review, the July-August issue, we had an issue on socialism and ecological survival, because it's now necessary, since we haven't done things and because the extreme weather events are now on us in a very real way and can't be stopped. Although we haven't reached planetary tipping points, the damage to our societies and to people, the cities and everything is becoming immense. We have to think about on a community level in terms of our organizations. We have to think about designing things for survival, not in terms of the elitist notion of resilience, which is all about putting this on the back of individuals or poor people, but actually creating organizations for ecological survival that protect people and communities, and particularly the poor. And from that, we can also develop the organizations. We also have to fight for mitigation. We have to fight on an immensely greater scale to stop the climate change and to stop these other forms of environmental destruction, or we won't have anything left. So it really is an immediate and pressing responsibility of everyone. And we're sort of collectively, like Nero, basically playing the fiddle while Rome burns. We're seeing the planet already destabilizing, at least as a safe home for humanity. And what are we doing? Well, we sent over $100 billion this last year in military equipment to Ukraine. Now, whatever, you know, you can look at the Ukraine war in various ways, but they've said that there's no money to deal with climate change, that we can't really, you know, we can't have an emergency government program. We don't have the money for it. But suddenly we have more than $100 billion in a year for a war. And we have to get our priorities straight, because the entire planet and the population of the earth is in danger. I expect the organizing on this to come principally from the global south at first, because in the United States, this is Fortress America. We tend to, this is the, really the most conservative place on earth, and at least our system has given us that role. We're at the core of the global imperial system, so we tend to not act and try to retain our power. And right now, the United States is expanding pipelines, spending trillions of dollars expanding pipelines and fracking, and we're sending oil and natural gas abroad. We're now the leading producer of fossil fuels on the earth, selling it all over the world. And this is contributing to climate change. And we pretend that we're protecting the environment because our emissions have gone down somewhat. But we are now the biggest producer of fossil fuels in the earth. And if you have a look at, there are studies of excess carbon emissions. And in the carbon budget, every country has a certain fair share of carbon emissions, historic carbon emissions, based on their population. They have a certain share of the global per capita emissions. And the United States, its historic emissions are, by subtracting the fair share from the amount of emissions a country has actually had, you can determine what countries have had excess emissions beyond their fair share. And 40% of all the excess carbon emissions in the world have been produced by the United States, or have been consumed by the United States, or part of U.S. consumption, U.S. emissions. So we account for 40% of the excess emissions in the entire world. We're way beyond our per capita share, and we have a responsibility for it. And if Americans organize on this basis and recognize, and of course we have to be concerned on this issue with the entire planet, we can have an effect because the U.S. is at the core of the system. And my strategy, one of my strategies would be, let's make the fossil fuel companies the enemies, not just in terms of a disinvestment project, but let's just organize completely against fossil fuel companies. They're the fascists of our time, let's say. Create a popular front between radicals, working class, and people within the elites who realize that we have to protect the earth, and go after the fossil fuel companies, make them the enemy, and do everything we can to obstruct them, to stop them, to block them. That's one strategy. We have a lot of things we can do, but we have to organize, and we have to have principles of organization. And we actually have to realize that there's an enemy out there. This isn't caused by the population as a whole. It's really caused by a system that is irrational and destructive and is the enemy of us all. And that's really capitalism. But we could target fossil fuel capital or fossil capital and organize on that basis. So far, that hasn't been tried.
Hi, folks. You're listening to KB Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here, talking to John Bellamy Foster, whose specialty is showing why capitalism cannot stop. That the dominant elites of the world, if most recognize the climate roasting threat, they have deceived themselves that we can make it, they think, with new technologies and just continue capitalist growth and permit them to buy ever bigger yachts. That means that it's us progressives and must gain the authority to direct the mobilization of our great resources that could vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and end global warming. That mobilization, of course, would require convincing the United States public that we, humanity, must embark on four courses of action. The first two have, in fact, long been priorities of our climate action groups and movements. And we have shown that technologies that capital wants to rely on either don't work, like carbon taxes, or are dangerous, like nuclear plants and geoengineering, or are very expensive and require years of research and build-out. The second objective, we conducted campaigns of civil disobedience to stop fossil fuel exploration, extraction, refining, and transportation. We have come a long way towards convincing that fossil fuel burning must be ended and the fossil fuel industry shut down and dismantled. And that will become more clear as global warming becomes more dangerous and destructive. It is the other two of the four objectives that require a great increase in the work of the climate action movement. So the third objective is demonstrating that we, humanity, can succeed in stopping global roasting and in the process create a healthier and more democratic societies, that we can do it quickly and relatively cheaply, that we have a solution to make our cities, especially because they are responsible for 70% or so of today's greenhouse gas pollution, to build out in the cities renewable sun and wind energy, and also many larger installations within 100 miles. Why? To avoid the time and vast expense of locating our sun and wind plantations way out in the countryside, and to bring the electricity to consumers, we'd have to build hundreds of thousands of miles of big nature-destroying grids that are only as reliable as their most vulnerable pylons. Finally, also vitally important, objective four, we'll have to transform all our production and living systems to use less energy. Why? Because if we need ever more energy, even from renewable sources, it will require more installations, more resources, and more time. How to reduce energy needs? Start with building out convenient public transport and investing in other transportation alternatives like biking and walking, all reducing the need for cars and reducing noise and congestion. So, John Foster, elaborate on all this, the need for an economic and social transformation.
Well, I agree with all that you said about model cities, and I was actually commenting on that in terms of survival strategies, because now it's really a question of survival. These things have to be done out of necessity, but we can also see it in terms of improvements of life, more collective, sustainable existence, showing that we can live differently and better, that in some ways smaller but better. And there are all sorts of things that we can do, and you listed quite a few of them. And I think that that has to be done on a community level, and it has to be seen now not simply as some sort of moral, ethical issue, but actually as an issue of human survival that corresponds with human freedom, because I think freedom and necessity are coming together. We have to create a more social, equitable world, a more collective way of living, one where we're concerned with the welfare of all, in order to have a rational approach to our environment and for purposes of survival. So the necessity and issues of social freedom come together in a way that is quite remarkable in our time. And yeah, I know what you're saying about cities. I mean, I remember being in Brussels in Belgium, and on Sundays they stop all traffic going into the inner city. And then, I mean, they will have trains that come up to the outskirts of the city, but there are no cars in the middle of the city. And it's just remarkable being able to walk in the middle of a modern city, a major city like that, and there are no cars. Everybody is walking through the city. It creates instant community. It creates an instant sense of collectivity and sustainability and really kind of a sense of freedom. And you know, we in the United States associate cars with freedom, but it's only because we have no alternatives in terms of transportation, and otherwise you're stuck. But in my classes, I was talking to students about, for example, cars and driving, and said, well, we could reduce our automobile emissions by 10%. And students said, well, that's not possible. We couldn't do that. And I said, well, sure, we could just drive 10% less, quite apart from the technological aspects. And we could set up a system that required 10% less automobile driving. After all, we're the most automobile-dependent nation on Earth, and it's totally irrational. We could save energy and so on in that way. And it's just, we talk as though we live in a rational system in terms of energy use and in terms of what we produce. so that if we have a solution to climate change, we still have to produce all this stuff and we still have to use as much energy as before, but that's irrational. First of all, we have all these other environmental problems that are also the product of our economy. I didn't mention when I was going over planetary boundaries, ocean acidification, which is another great issue, which is a result of carbon dioxide as well. But we have all of these problems, and it's not true that all the stuff that we produce is necessary and rational and meets human needs. In fact, the great bulk of it is actually waste by any standard, ecological waste, social waste, human waste, because human labor goes into producing it. So we have to rethink all of these things. And if we weren't such a destructive and wasteful society, we could use those resources to actually meet human needs and create a more sustainable society. And we can build this from the community level up. But we also have to be concerned, since time is so short and we don't want to cross these planetary boundaries, we can't, because we're looking in the face of human extinction. And if we go very far down this road in the next couple of decades, I mean, that's all we've got to in order to transform this, really, according to the science. We have to be operating also at a national level. We have to find a way to stop the fossil fuel companies and from taking all these fossil fuels out of the ground, and then they're emitted all over the globe, whether it's emitted by us or not. We have to keep the fossil fuels in the ground. So we're now in the middle of the greatest struggle of all human history, and I don't know if we will win, but I do know that hundreds of millions, even billions of people around the world will be drawn into this struggle to save the planet as a safe place for humanity and to create a more collective, sustainable, and egalitarian world. And what we can do is join that struggle, and as hard in as many ways as we can.
Thank you, John Bellamy Foster. He teaches at the University of Oregon. He's written a whole lot of books. They include Ecological Rift, Capitalism, War on Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. His work is animated by recognizing that our system was working to, in fact, extinguish millions of species and possibly Homo sapiens. It's also animated by a recognition that we have all the tools to, in fact, change that very radically and move towards a possible necessary democratic society that gives people real freedom, not just freedom to drive the freeways and cage your iron machine. So thanks a lot for talking to us today, John Bellamy Foster. Let's talk again.
Thank you. I would be glad to.
Go back to the mountain. Oh, oh, so is life. Ha, ha, so is life. Do you know who I am? Do I know who you are? See we one another clearly. Do we know who we are? Do you know who I am? Do I know who we are? See we one another clearly. Do we know who we are? See you know who I am? Do I know who you are? See we one another clearly. Do we know who we are? Oh, oh, so is life about you are. So is life. Oh, oh, so is life about you are. So is life.
River, river, watch the mountain fire, make the sunlight turn the world around. Heart is of the river, body is the mountain, spirit is the sunlight, turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around. We are of the spirit, truly of the spirit, only can the spirit turn the world around.
Real classic there by Harry Belafonte, who we lost last week. The song Turn the World Around followed Bill Resnick talking with John Bellamy Foster, an educator at the University of Oregon and editor of the Monthly Review. Again, you can find part one of that interview as part of the April 10, 2023 episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Search for that at kboo.fm. Up next, Fran Michel discusses two recent books titled Health Communism and Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice, offering counter-arguments to the abandonment of public health. Here's Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The Biden administration's decision to end the pandemic emergency declaration and related programs means not only the end to free vaccines and tests and the chance for big pharma to raise vaccine prices exorbitantly, it also means ending telehealth options and depriving some 15 million Americans of access to Medicaid, including nearly 7 million who'll still be poor enough to qualify but are unlikely to be able to meet the paperwork requirements. It means ending supplemental food support programs, even though food banks have been hard-pressed to meet people's needs even with the additional federal support. It continues a process of abandoning the spirit of public health that's been under attack from officials at least since the CDC told us that those who are vaccinated need not wear a mask. To be clear, the end of the emergency declaration does not mean the end of the pandemic, which is likely to become even more damaging as it continues to spread with even fewer checks, and thus to evolve ever more variants of unpredictable severity. What we can predict is that the effects of this pandemic, and the next ones sure to come, will inflict most damage on those already disadvantaged. As is well known, people of color have experienced higher levels of infection and death from COVID-19. Women and trans people have been more likely to experience long COVID, the persistent symptoms that can last weeks, months, or years after the initial infection. These disparities are not the effects of some inherent weakness or failure in oppressed groups, despite what fascist health supremacists might suggest, but the cumulative impact of suffering that oppression. In their 2021 book, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice, authors Rupa Maurya and Raj Patel draw a series of analogies between the body and the planet as they explore the systemic inflammation resulting from capitalism and colonialism. The book explains that when tissues are damaged or threatened, our immune system sends cells and molecular messengers that attack invaders, repair damage, and restore the body to health. Sometimes the response doesn't switch off, and the result is a chronic inflammatory state. When that happens, the body's healing mechanism is transformed into a smoldering fire that creates ongoing harm. Leading causes of this chronic inflammation include malnutrition, environmental toxins, and stress. That is, lack of adequate food, proximity to toxins, for instance, because of dangerous workplaces or the siting of toxic dumps near Black, Brown, and Indigenous homes, and stress, the result of suffering the effects of structural, institutional, and interpersonal racism, sexism, and other oppressions, all lead to chronic inflammation, which contributes to cancer, heart disease, diabetes, colitis, asthma, and other illnesses. Maurya and Patel argue that individuals can be healthy only when the entire community is also healthy. This is achievable only through social, economic, political, ecological, and cosmological spheres working in an integrated fashion for the benefit of all. Obviously, this integration is not what's currently happening, but a persuasive account of what is happening in the current political economy of healthcare can be found in Health Communism by Beatrice Adler-Bolton and Arnie Vierkant, co-hosts of the Death Panel podcast. Adler-Bolton and Vierkant argue that capitalism makes a fuzzy and unstable but crucial distinction between two populations, the workers and the surplus. And capitalist healthcare is the system of managing the surplus, the unwanted, discarded bodies viewed as waste. We can see this division being made in the way that disability is defined, for instance, when Social Security Disability Insurance uses this simplified metric of how a particular illness or condition impacts an individual's capacity to work. Moreover, those in the worker category constantly face the threat of falling into the latter category, since the surplus includes ex-workers who are no longer producing capital, whether because of age or other factors. But while this system treats certain populations as surplus, as waste, it also depends on these populations. The surplus become a source of profit, with various industries developing to extract value from them, whether through policing or through care. In April 2020, as the pandemic took hold in the U.S., as hospitals were overwhelmed with COVID patients and health workers were hailed as essential and heroic, 1.4 million hospital workers were laid off. As the New York Times put it at the time, plunging revenues from canceled non-emergency medical appointments have forced hospitals to furlough or cut the pay of doctors, nurses, and other staff, tossing many of those workers into the surplus category. Meanwhile, as Eric Reinhart noted in a Times opinion piece about the demoralization of medical workers, ostensibly nonprofit charity hospitals have illegally saddled poor patients with debt for receiving care to which they were entitled without cost, and have turned large profits by exploiting tax incentives meant to promote care for poor communities. Hospitals are deliberately understaffing themselves and undercutting patient care while sitting on billions of dollars in cash reserves. Adler-Bolton and Vierkant describe this process as extractive abandonment, a concept they develop by drawing on Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work on imprisonment and the notion of organized state abandonment, and Marta Russell's work on capitalism and disability. For Wilson Gilmore, this abandonment appears as a withdrawal of the state, but is actually a strategy of racial capitalist state formation to exploit vulnerable communities, and it signals the process of governing populations through callous yet purposeful neglect, framing many humans and other life forms as surplus to the contemporary political economic order. Health Communism also draws on Marta Russell's money model of disability, which theorizes that while the disabled, the surplus population, are widely regarded as a drain on the economy, in truth, over time, capital and the state have constructed systems to reclaim this lost population as a source of financial production. Russell situates these systems as manifesting through charity fundraising, the prioritization of care aimed toward the repair of disabled people to become workers, and through policies that grow the private sector through for-profit private nursing home care, paid for by publicly funded, means-tested state healthcare programs. Ultimately, the authors of Health Communism call for left projects to center the waste, because deviants, the surplus, and the sick form the central class that can bring about the fall of capital. They argue that it is not necessarily the case that we are all sick, but none of us is well. Health is a biological fascist fantasy, a subjective dream of an unattenuated wellness, a body state they deny any being has ever known. Capital has emphasized and corrupted the delineations between surplus classes for its convenience. It's immeasurably threatening to capital to see a group of those it has deemed to be waste come together in solidarity. The truth of the distinction that capitalist states draw in their demarcations of worker versus surplus is that in the eyes of capital, we are all surplus. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel discussing the books Inflamed and Health Communism, both available through the Multnomah County Public Library.
Electricity by the Avalanches, following Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, Patricia Kohlberg reads excerpts from an open letter to educational authorities by prominent black educators, writers, and activists calling for resistance to so-called anti-woke attacks on teachers, libraries, and schools. Here's Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Mr. Murray was my junior year high school English teacher. He was a soft-spoken, tweed vest sort of guy with a vague British accent who insisted on calling us by our last names, Miss Kohlberg, for example. Maybe that was his sense of formality and propriety, but I always felt it was his way of flattening the high school authority structure, of elevating us to his level. Mostly, we loved him because he inspired us to think, which is exactly what a good high school teacher is supposed to do. Many of us are lucky enough to have encountered exceptional teachers like Mr. Murray. Unfortunately, it is harder and harder for that sort of teacher to flourish in today's educational environment. Tomorrow, Tuesday, May 2nd, is National Teachers' Day. Today, in honor of Mr. Murray and millions of other fine teachers, I would like to read an edited version of an open letter by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Angela Davis, Nicole Hannah-Jones, Ibram X. Kendi, Gloria Steinem, Cornel West, and many others, entitled Educational Authorities Must Resist Anti-Woke Censorship. It was published in The Guardian on March 8th of this year, and you can find a link to the original article on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. The letter begins, as academics, artists, advocates, policymakers, and concerned persons, we emphatically oppose the attacks being waged on educational curricula in the United States against intersectionality, critical race theory, black feminism, queer theory, and other frameworks that address structural inequality. These attacks have led to book banning, curriculum censorship, politically motivated purges of educators, and an exodus of skilled teachers. Since the summer of 2020, an emboldened and well-resourced faction in the United States has declared war on hard-fought advances in civil and human rights, social justice, and democratic participation. This faction, which includes multiple state legislators and governors, has attempted to censor concepts that sprang to life out of decades of struggle against racism, sexism, ableism, colonialism, and related forms of domination. They have attacked librarians, surveilled and harassed teachers, canceled classes, banned books, and weaponized the law to forbid ideas, frameworks, and viewpoints in the nation's schools, colleges, and workplaces. The consequences of the assault on these ideas are painfully evident in the rollout of the College Board's Advanced Placement African American Studies curriculum, a college-level course available for high school students. The College Board's interest in launching the curriculum was reinvigorated by the movement sparked by the killing of George Floyd. The movement increased the demand for ways of understanding and defeating systemic racism. It also ignited a powerful backlash. Yet the College Board remained silent when this conservative backlash collided with their stated objectives in launching the course. When the College Board finally made public its long-awaited African American Studies course, students were left with a watered-down curriculum. Lessons pertaining to intersectionality, Black queer studies, and Black feminism had been removed entirely or downgraded to untested optional material subject to state and local censors. Dr. Jason Manoharan from the College Board disclosed that he deleted intersectionality because the term had been drained of its meaning and filled up with political rhetoric. In response, we ask, drained of meaning for whom? And by what authority does a single individual or institution decide that a term used by people all over the world was so valueless as to be excluded from any classroom, much less one on African American studies? If all terms can be censored from a college-level curriculum simply because they have been politically contested, then the College Board ought not include liberalism, populism, freedom, culture, or even democracy in their curricula. Far from being drained of value, intersexual frames have been indispensable in the work many of us have done to uncover unwritten histories, to analyze overlooked social problems, and to address current human rights failures. We find the College Board's politicized decision to remove intersectionality from the African American Studies curriculum to be disgraceful and dangerous. The suppression of knowledge and the delegitimizing of Black intellectuals are tried and true tools of racial retrenchment and oppression. Compliance with today's anti-woke imperatives is likewise grounded in recovering a mythic past in which the subservient role of women and the rigidity of race, gender, and sexuality is established and secured. It is disappointing that any educational institution would acquiesce to that distortion. The arc of history bends backwards if we allow our conceptual assets to be stripped away. We cannot expect anyone to understand problems we are no longer permitted to name or to prepare for a future we cannot imagine. The fight for our ideas, our language, and our history is critical to the fight for our lives. Thus, we demand that the College Board restore critical concepts, scholarship, and frameworks to the African American Studies course. More broadly, we call on responsible leaders at the College Board, in public education, and beyond, to lend their considerable resources to support educators and students whose freedom to teach and to learn is compromised by state-sponsored repression and threats to their very well-being. In this pivotal moment in which illiberal censorship is cresting around the world, it is a betrayal of democratic values for any responsible leaders to actively participate, to stand by, or to capitulate to such destruction. Because we know repression in one place fuels its spread elsewhere, we call for global resistance to all efforts to destroy the vital tools that help us to imagine and create more equitable and inclusive futures for all of us. That was an edited version of an open letter, which was published March 8th in The Guardian, entitled, Educational Authorities Must Resist Anti-Woke Censorship. This has been Patricia Kullberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you.
System 7 by Bela Fleck, following Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode from the archives, The Meaning of May Day. Fran Michel and Hyung Nam discuss May Day's origins in the Chicago riot of 1886. This segment originally aired April 27 in 2015. Here's Fran Michel and Hyung Nam for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
There is power, there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power, that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Have you got that again?
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Hyung Nam to talk about May Day.
So some of the struggles that we will be addressing will be not only things like healthcare and the rising cost of housing, that if we really consider how wages have been stagnant, but the cost of healthcare, which really, even when people have insurance, not only the rising premiums, but growing out-of-pocket costs, cost sharing, deductibles, and so on, and rising price of housing really has meant that if we count those costs rather than just the cost of food, that poverty levels are actually much higher than they are officially. If we count those costs, poverty levels right now are more like 51%. And so this is a serious time that we need to not only fight for a minimum wage floor of at least 15, but single-payer health care and many other issues as well.
The history of May Day has been about worker solidarity. It started most famously in relation to demands for the 8-hour day in the late 19th century.
Yes, our struggles today that we are highlighting and also celebrating the activism and work of many different groups really is a continuation of the struggles from the very first roots of May Day, which have to do not only with workers' rights, but also struggle of immigrants as workers, struggle against racism, struggle against the police that have historically sided to protect capitalists against labor.
Yeah, I mean, famously, the Haymarket riots, as they were called, came about in Chicago after there was a workers' demonstration on May Day in 1886, which was part of the call for an 8-hour day, and the police killed a number of strikers in the Chicago area. So there were then demonstrations in response and protest against that police violence, which led to further police harassment and violence. A bomb was thrown. It wasn't really clear who was responsible for that, but certainly the people who were shot by police. And then a number of activists were tried and executed for having thrown the bomb. So there is a long history, and this is sort of one of the key incidents in the historical development of May Day. So there is a long history both of police repression in response to workers' demands and that sort of ongoing struggle, which we obviously see continuing today.
Yes, exactly. And it's not, you know, just May Day, but throughout history, we've seen that as workers organize to assert their rights against the power of capital, over and over again, they are attacked and intimidated and threatened by not only the police, sometimes hired thugs, whether it be the Pinkertons or the Baldwin Felts, who at one point were a larger army than our actual army of the United States, or, you know, the National Guard. Repeatedly, this has always been about class war.
Yeah. Famously, May Day was associated with the demand for the 8-hour day, for the reduction of working hours. But of course, the real struggle behind that, the demands of May Day are really about worker control. And it's not just for reduced hours. I mean, today, for a lot of people, the question is getting enough hours or getting enough money for the hours that they're working. So there are all kinds of issues associated with the demand for greater control over one's life, over one's work.
Exactly. From the very roots of May Day to today, it's really the same struggle. It's the struggle of people coming together to organize and assert their rights to not have our lives completely dominated by capital and to really challenge capital and to assert that really another world is possible where our lives are not completely dominated for the 1% to enrich themselves and squeeze ever more productivity out of people. A life where we can enjoy our life that we can not only earn enough through our work, but that we can actually live our lives so that we can do what Marx talked about, that one could hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, and criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic.
There's a passage from Rosa Luxemburg when she talks about the history of May Day. The 1st of May demanded the introduction of the 8-hour day, but even after this goal was reached, May Day was not given up. As long as the struggle of the workers against the bourgeoisie and the ruling class continues, as long as all demands are not met, May Day will be the yearly expression of these demands. And when better days dawn, when the working class of the world has won its deliverance, then too humanity will probably celebrate May Day in honor of the bitter struggles and the many sufferings of the past.
Yes, that is an excellent quote, and it makes us think about the ongoing struggles today that are really fundamentally, although they are fundamentally the same struggles, I think it's also important to just highlight some of the ways that they have evolved. For instance, in San Francisco, workers have successfully fought for a retail workers' bill of rights, because what we are seeing is the same dynamic of capital squeezing more and more productivity out of workers to increase their profits, which is what workers were originally struggling against when they were demanding an 8-hour day as opposed to working 14-hour shifts. Today, we're seeing computer algorithms being used to do just-in-time scheduling, where workers are supposed to throw everything down from their families, whether it's childcare or whatever, so that they can be scheduled on demand by their employers so that they can maximize production and make record profits while workers' wages have been stagnant and we are facing record levels of inequality in America.
So where there was once this demand for 8 hours of work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for what you will, now it's apparently 24 hours for whatever the boss wills, if you don't know what's going to come in your next hours.
Exactly. We have such amazing potential with the technology that has been created. And instead of this technology being used to actually improve workers' lives, just as we saw originally with May Day as industrialization was happening, this technology is being used to just squeeze more profits and productivity from the workers rather than improving human lives.
And there are so many areas of human lives and so many dimensions in which lives need improvement. I think of the passage in the first volume of Capital where Marx calls attention to the way that the movement for the 8-hour day really took off after the end of the Civil War in the U.S. And he commented that in the United States of America, any sort of independent labor movement was paralyzed so long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor with a white skin cannot emancipate itself where labor with a black skin is branded. But out of the death of slavery, a new vigorous life sprang. The first fruits of the Civil War was an agitation for the 8-hour day, a movement which ran with express speed from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California. So there is this important element of the struggle for workers' rights, which is it's when we rise up in solidarity that we'll be able to really create the better world that we all know is possible.
To celebrate the struggles of workers all over the world who celebrate this day as Labor Day, actually, instead of our Labor Day that has been divorced from our own history of very inspiring organizing and struggles of workers, but also to continue to build and strengthen these coalitions so that we can avoid that kind of division that capital really thrives on, and that we can build these networks so that we can struggle together for the 99%. It is a long struggle, and as Rosa Luxemburg said, hopefully we will get to the point eventually where all we do for May Day is just celebrate our complete success.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel talking with Hyung Nam.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for May 1st, 2023. I'm John Nelson with an announcement before we go. This coming Saturday, May 6th, labor and community activists will gather for a Portland Troublemaker School. The school is organized by Labor Notes and sponsored by many local unions. Thanks to our sponsors, registration is only $10 and includes the all-important caffeine service of tea or coffee, light breakfast, snacks, and lunch. Want to organize your workplace? Take on a bully boss? Run a powerful contract campaign? Strike and win? Join us at McDaniel High School, 2735 Northeast 82nd Avenue, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. this Saturday, May 6. Register online at labornotes.org/PDX. The Portland labor movement is kicking it up. At our interactive workshops, you'll share your knowledge and learn from other labor activists, from teachers and healthcare workers to warehouse workers and dock workers. This is a school for everyone, new activists and seasoned organizers alike. Again, that's the Portland Troublemaker School, Saturday, May 6th at McDaniel High School. Get more information and register at labornotes.org/PDX. Thanks to Fran Michelle, Patricia Kohlberg, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests John Foster and Hyung Nam. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kbu.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.